Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 1,000 years ago, a pope intent on shoring up his powers launched the First Crusade. Christian theology, military strategy, and Christian-Muslim relations have never been the same. The millennium-old conflict got renewed public attention after September 11, 2001. 5 days after the terrorist attacks, President Bush told reporters that the United States was facing, quote, a new kind of evil.
We understand. And the American people are beginning to understand. This crusade, this war on terrorism is going to take a while.
After a public outcry, President Bush stopped using the word crusade when talking about the war on terror. But for some, including many in the Muslim world, the specter of the crusades lingers in the Middle East's battles today. Their shadow, even for a 21st century U.S. president, is hard to escape. Two new histories of the Crusades are out. They offer new perspective on the motives of the rulers and the fighters of that time, on the clanking armies of 1,000 years ago, and their echoes in the nightly news of 2004. Tonight on Point, the Crusades, Christendom, Islam, and the resonance of those medieval battles today. You can join the conversation. Do you know who threw the first stone in the 200-year Crusades? And if we crusade against cancer and drunk driving, what do you call the effort to bring democracy to the Middle East today? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from London is Thomas Asbridge, author of The First Crusade, A New History. He's a senior lecturer in early medieval history at Queen Mary, University of London. Thomas Asbridge, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us from London, Jonathan Phillips, author of The Fourth Crusade and the Sack of Constantinople. He is also senior lecturer in medieval history at Royal Holloway, University of London. Jonathan Phillips, thank you very much for joining us.
Good evening.
It's wonderful to have you both. History so long ago has never seemed more relevant. It seems that every, I don't know, you tell us, generation or century, we get a new interpretation of the Crusades. Let's just dive in. There's a lot we want to know about the detail. We won't have time for nearly as much as you've given in these marvelous, this marvelous pair of books. But let me just ask you, Thomas Asbridge, off the bat, why did the Crusades happen?
Well, I think one of the most important things to put across straight away, and I guess one of the central messages of my book, is to recognize and to drive home a key point. And that is that the First Crusade, preached right at the end of the 11th century, wasn't launched in response to some kind of imminent threat from Islam to Western Europe. It's not as if Islam was literally about to invade the West. It's not as if the Pope who launched this idea of a crusade was perceiving that literally the walls of Rome were going to be overrun.
Right. No terror attack, no imminent threat. So why?
Well, I think there's two things to be aware of. One is that central to his message was the idea that a key city, the city of Jerusalem, needed to be reconquered.
And this is Pope Urban II we're talking about.
This is Pope Urban II. Mm-hmm. The problem he had was that Jerusalem had actually fallen to Islam nearly more than 400 years before. So this is not exactly fresh news. He can't claim this is a recent atrocity.
Right.
So instead what he does is argue, really using very much propagandistic images and drawing not upon reality, but I think very much upon his imagination, that Islam is abusing and attacking Christians living in the Holy Land, they are literally carrying out religious crimes against Christians in the East.
Was
and
that
this
true?
Is an attack. No, this wasn't true. There'd been some incidences in the previous 100 years of pilgrims having difficulty reaching Jerusalem. But on the, you know, if you're looking at in total, effectively relations between Christians and Muslims, both on frontiers in the Byzantine Empire, which is the Eastern Roman Empire, and in the Holy Land itself, were fairly normalized. And Islam had shown real tolerance to Christianity in the preceding 2 to 3 centuries.
So Jerusalem was incredibly important to the Christians at that time. You have illustrations in these books of drawings that show Jerusalem as the navel
of the world, and yet it had been in Islamic hands for 400 years and hadn't been a problem. So what was it, Thomas Asbridge, here in the 11th century that was suddenly driving this pope to say, to campaign around Europe for Christendom to rise up and go to battle?
Well, I wouldn't want to depict Urban in a two-dimensional manner. I mean, it'd be very easy to describe him as some kind of megalomaniac, a man who's looking for his own power. I think he's aware that launching this idea of a crusade is going to bring more authority to the papacy. It's striking that just a few years before he launches the crusade, he's actually in a very weak position. He doesn't even have control of Rome because the papacy's been through a sort of an internal war.
Mm-hmm.
But what I think is also, we have to realize that it's not just all about power for him. He, as a pope, he is aware of the fact that in his position, he's responsible for the souls of everyone in Western Europe. And sin is weighing very heavily on people's minds in the 11th century. And the crusade is a way to both to fight for Christendom, but also to relieve sin, to cancel out the debt of sin. And so I think he's also trying to open the door to people. He's also trying to give a way to knights and to soldiers to find a road to salvation. So I think it's two things. It's to do with power, and it's also to do with him having a spiritual vision.
They could cleanse their souls. They could achieve salvation by going on a crusade. Jonathan Phillips, let me put the same question to you. Two wonderful books, and two different perspectives in some degree. Well, the simple question to you, we've got the background in a nutshell here, but why? Jerusalem had been in Muslim hands for 400 years. What's your answer to why this pope decided at this time to rally all of Europe on such an enormous and expensive undertaking?
Yeah, I agree with Tom here. I think it's very much a way of offering people a sort of a way to salvation. It's also a way of directing the energies of the knights of Western Europe. I mean, they're very violent. They're fighting with one another. They pick up on the church from time to time. It's a way of channeling those energies, directing them towards something that Urban II himself at that time sees as a virtuous target, and that is to remove the infidel from the holy places.
So you're putting the search for salvation on a par with the pope's need to stabilize his authority, to cement his authority, Jonathan Phillips?
Yeah, I think those things are both very, very important to him.
Let's get a sense of how each of these two crusades got going. Thomas Asbridge, first, you've written about the first crusades here. In a nutshell, how were these carried out? We have all kinds of images in our heads of knights on horseback and people's crusades. How did this get started?
Well, effectively, Urban launched this idea of a crusade in a particular speech, a sermon he gave in southern France in 1095. But what's important to realize is that it didn't just lead to a knightly army, and what we might imagine as some kind of splendid armor-clad army sending off themselves to the Holy Land. What we see actually is a very widespread response, something perhaps even in the region of 100,000 people responded to this call to go to Jerusalem to reconquer the Holy Land. But they were from all walks of life, right from the upper echelons of aristocracy.
Hello, Thomas Asbridge.
So it's a real cross-section of society that respond to this idea. And what happens effectively is that they march in excess of 3,000 miles overland. And against all the odds, they manage to overcome Islamic resistance. And in 1099, they actually retake Jerusalem in what we now almost regard almost as a miraculous victory.
And this marching right around the Mediterranean, Constantinople and Byzantium, the Eastern Christian city of splendor, figured hugely in this, and of course ends up, as you write, Jonathan Phillips, sacked at the end of it all. But in the First Crusade and right on through, it was a key point. Describe, if you would, the Christian world for us in those days, and how Rome and Constantinople played off one another, how the roles they played each in the Crusades.
Well, the Christian world's really got two centers. I mean, as you say, in Rome there is the Pope, the head of the Catholic Church, but there is to the east is the way that the Roman Empire survived after the attacks of the Goths in the 4th century. They moved to Constantinople, the new Rome. I mean, we call them Byzantines. In fact, mm-hmm. they call themselves Romans.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this wonderful, wonderful city created in the 4th century, about eight times bigger than any other city in Western Europe at the time. Splendid, filled with churches, wonderful palaces, things like that. It really is a remarkable, remarkable city.
Far larger, far more wealthy, and was Constantinople, which was a competitor of Rome, was it cooperative in the Crusades at the beginning?
In the beginning, the very beginning, yes, I think it was. One of the other reasons we could have actually put forward for the call to the First Crusade is a request from the Byzantine Emperor for some mercenaries to help him. He famously asked for sort of 200 or 300 mercenaries. He got 100,000
and 200 years of crusade.
Zealous Christians. Yeah, and his city sacked 109 years later, which wasn't what he anticipated, of course.
No.
The Greek emperor's in a tricky position. If you've got 50 or 60,000 people plus turning up on your doorstep, how do you deal with that? You can't. You can either be sort of fairly gentle with them. You can give them food and drink and hope that they move on quickly. You could try and take them on, although that's obviously got risks too. They have to play a sort of diplomatic game, a sort of carrot and stick affair of trying to move these people away from their wonderful city, the Queen of Cities, as they called it, not being overrun by them.
And Thomas Asbridge, when this great motley army, I guess the people's army motley, the later army, more potent, moved on east and then south toward Jerusalem. Describe for us the kind of fighting that went on. How were they perceived and received by the Muslim cities and forces? What sort of conflict was this?
Well, I think one of the things that's quite striking about the whole venture is exactly how deadly it was for the Crusaders. We think something like 90% of the people who started the First Crusade died along the route, and a large percentage of that, a large proportion of that, is made up of people dying from illness and starvation, not through direct battle. So this is an intensely grueling experience for these people. It's very protracted in terms of the number of years that take place. They face kinds of weather and suffering that they were expecting in the Holy Land, a land that they'd been and described to them as a land flowing with milk and honey, to face, you know, terrible winds and storms and even snow and rain, and really intense starvation. So that's one of the enemies that they're facing and that they have to endure. In terms of the Muslim reaction, I think, to draw a parallel with the modern world, what the Muslims really face is shock or respond with real shock and awe to what the Crusaders bring. Islam has been used to dealing with the Byzantines, as we've just been discussing. They've been used, I think, to normalized diplomatic relations. Yes, military conflict from time to time, but really these are neighboring powers that relate to each other like any other neighboring power. Suddenly, what appears on the horizon with the First Crusade is a new type of force, a force that isn't necessarily going to be prepared to negotiate, that has got one thing on its mind, and that is the conquest of Jerusalem. And I think the level of violence that the Crusaders bring to the table and their relative intransigence, their unwillingness to make a deal with Islam when it really comes down to it, these are new things that Islam's not ready to deal with.
Can I just chip in on one thing,
please,
that Tom was talking about, the casualty rate there?
Yes.
I think it's. I mean, the casualty rates were enormous, and yet crusading goes on, and there's at least 200 years plus of crusading activity. And I think the fact that the West is prepared to tolerate casualty rates of the nature that Tom was talking about, some other crusades, we know they're 30, 40% plus, a modern general wouldn't go into a battle, and his people would not tolerate that, I suspect.
Medieval
society is prepared to endorse that and again set out, knowing that that kind of loss is going to be incurred.
They were violent societies from the get-go, and it was tied into salvation, which made put their souls at stake. Jonathan Phillips, you've written about the very, very long-term consequences of the Crusades. We want to hear a lot more about the details, but when you sit here in 2004, what consequences are we still in the midst of today?
Well, there's a mixture. Obviously, you have the basic point that crusading is regarded as a struggle between Christianity and Islam. In these terms, you can have an aggressive Westerner coming in, conquering, settling lands in the Middle East, killing people in the Middle East. That's a parallel that can be drawn today very, very easily by those in the Islamic world seeking to. Also, I think in my book, when I talk about the sack of Constantinople, we've got to remember that crusades were turned against people other than Muslims. The Fourth Crusade ended up killing thousands and thousands of Christians. And this, too, is something that was still felt through the centuries. And earlier in the summer of 2001, Pope John Paul II actually apologized to the Greek Orthodox Church for the Fourth Crusade. So the long-standing, the afterlife, if you like, of these movements is certainly still with us.
We have a lot more we want to learn about these two crusades. We've got two wonderful authors with us tonight. Thomas Asbridge is with us from London. He's author of the new book, The First Crusade, A New History. And Jonathan Phillips, also in London, author of The Fourth Crusade and the Sack of Constantinople. We're talking about the crusades, Christendom versus Islam, and their continuing resonance today. You can join us. Do you know who threw the first stone in the 200-year Crusades? Are you hearing it tonight? And how deeply does the shadow of the Crusades touch Islam and the West today? And whether George Bush uses the word or not, is the U.S. embarked on a kind of new crusade in the Middle East now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Crusades, about Christendom versus Islam 1,000 years ago and the continuing resonance of those wars today. My guests tonight, joining us from the University of London, Thomas Asbridge, author of the new book, The First Crusade, A New History, and Jonathan Phillips, author of another, The First Crusade and the Sack of Constantinople, rich, deep tellings for a general audience of what went on in these two centuries of war. You can join the conversation tonight. Can you see the sacrifice and slaughter of the historical Crusades as a spiritual quest? Or was this just plunder and mayhem dressed up with a cross? And what about the impulse today to go and vanquish the other? Is it still at work? Are we still in the grips of a kind of crusading mindset, whether we acknowledge it or not? And if we are, what does that mean? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Thomas Asbridge, I wish you would make the battles of this time a bit more vivid for us. You've got some incredible descriptions in the book, you both do, of how brutal and difficult. We have beheadings going on today. They were even more spectacular then. Give us a sense of how warfare was carried out between these Christendom, I guess, and Islam at that time.
Well, I think it's important to recognize that, of course, we're talking about close-up violence here. This is intense and intimate violence when we're talking about literal battles between individuals, using swords, using materials that are going to cause, you know, instant bloodshed in front of them. And so I think people from both societies have been acculturated to the kind of level of violence that even modern soldiers might find quite distressing today. But it's also true that on both sides, both Christians and Muslims knew the power of violence, knew that morale-sapping acts that we might describe as war crimes were an important part and parcel, crucially, of siege warfare. One of the things that the Crusaders face is that during their march on Jerusalem, they decide to try and take a massive city called Antioch, mm-hmm. which is now right on the border between Turkey and Syria. And they're engaged in this for more than 8 months. And both sides during this period try to intimidate the enemy. What do the Crusaders do whenever they capture Muslims? They decapitate them and throw the heads of these dead Muslims over the walls of Antioch to intimidate the Muslim garrison. Mm. Likewise, the Muslims, I mean, they're by no means innocent of these crimes either. They pull out an Eastern Christian bishop that they have in their possession, mm-hmm. hang him over the walls by his feet and beat him with sticks in front of the crusading army. So both sides are playing with violence. They're using it not only as a means to prevail in battle, but also as a method to intimidate their enemy. And I think, I mean, you know, even writing about it, I found it difficult at times to sort of look this kind of violence in the face.
Very close
but
up.
It's an endemic part.
And it didn't stop when they reached the Holy Land. In fact, there's some kind of crescendo there. They had a 7-month siege of Antioch, and then ultimately on to Jerusalem. And that, too, I wish you'd describe how this Holy of Holies, this holy city, was taken.
Well, this is probably the most arresting moment and image of the First Crusade, and I would perhaps suggest of all the Crusades. It's the moment when the First Crusaders, after their long journey to the east, finally in 1099 break into Jerusalem on the 15th of July. And what they effectively unleash is an unholy wave of violence against the Muslims inside the city. Eyewitness sources describe how the Crusaders were wading ankle-deep in Muslim blood. That's how many people had been slaughtered. Mm. Babies had their heads smashed against walls. I mean, the descriptions are intensely distressing. But what's perhaps even more striking about this is that still covered in the blood of this slaughter, the Crusaders then went to what they perceived to be the most holy site on earth, what's known as the Holy Sepulchre, the supposed site of Christ's death and his resurrection. Mm. And they went there to give thanks to God for the fact that they'd prevailed and that they'd retaken Jerusalem. And it's this moment, I think, that sums up
the two really striking elements of crusading. On the one hand, extreme violence, and on the other, extraordinary piety. And it's a combination that seems almost unbelievable by modern terms, but it was a very real part of the medieval world. Mm.
You write that they came still covered in their enemies' blood, weighed down with booty, rejoicing and weeping with excessive gladness to worship at the sepulchre of our Savior Jesus. Jonathan Phillips, this captures the kind of contradictions of the Crusades quite succinctly. You both write about how the difficulty that medieval knights had with their status as sort of purveyors of violence who followed a religion that was staunchly opposed to violence and killing, and that by the time of the Fourth Crusade, crusaders were guaranteed absolution of confessed sins, a ticket straight to paradise if they would go and fight this battle.
Yeah, they are. They have to reconcile these two things. I think what the church has done in the 11th century is actually to construct a case where violence is spiritually meritorious. We think of Christianity as a sort of religion, you turn the other cheek, that kind of thing. But in the circumstances of the medieval world, there's a case whereby, particularly in a defensive situation, in other words, Muslims had taken Christian lands, i.e. Jerusalem. 400 years earlier, that you can actually respond with force, as long as it's not excessive force. The church tries to sort of guard the morality of the Crusades, obviously rather unsuccessfully, by trying to stress that you should only do this to a sort of limited extent. You shouldn't crusade for reasons of greed, envy, honor, seeking excess wealth. Now, human nature being what it is, people do go on crusade for these things, but it doesn't mean they can't go for religious reasons as well. I think what we struggle with these days, I think, and you actually sort of mentioned this earlier, you said people were either going for loot or for religious reasons. Well, I think in medieval times people can go for both, and it's not necessarily the either or that we see here. Sure, one can dominate the other, but they can fit them alongside.
And Thomas Asbridge, let me ask you, it seems that we were saying earlier, in every century, maybe every generation, the Crusades gets reinterpreted. There was a time a couple hundred years ago where everything to do with this period was exalted. In the wake of World War I and II and in the deep of the Cold War, the Crusades got quite a different image. One of your fellow English medievalists, Stephen Runciman, forgive me if I mispronounce it, wrote, and of course you know this, he wrote, "High ideals were besmirched by cruelty and greed, enterprise and endurance, by a blind and narrow self-righteousness, and the Holy War itself was nothing more than a long act of intolerance in the name of God." I'm reading him quoted here by Joan Acacella in The New Yorker, and she says that you two are out to reinterpret again, that if Cold War era historians had a deep distaste for crusading, for the legitimacy of the spiritual element here, that you're opening the door to it again and giving it credence. Is that right?
Well, I guess I've got two things to say on that. I think what I want to do as a historian, and I think Jonathan is exactly the same, is I want to try and understand the Middle Ages from the perspective of the Middle Ages, not necessarily try to impose my modern views, my modern beliefs on a historical understanding of the past. But I have to be, you know, I have to be absolutely clear about the fact that, of course, I find crusading warfare, I find all the violence on both sides abhorrent. You know, this is a difficult period to work on. It's a difficult period to detach yourself from emotionally. But if I want to write history that's dispassionate, that's accurate, and that doesn't attempt to be subjective, then I have to try and detach myself in that way. I read Joan Acacella's review in The New Yorker. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think her suggestion towards the end of her review that both Jonathan and I were in some sense seeking tacitly to endorse some kind of new form of Christian warfare or some kind of new Western aggression against Islam is I find that frankly quite distressing. I feel very distant from that. But the reason I don't explicitly state my views and the parallels within the book is that because I'm trying to write about the past with a view to what people were thinking in the 11th century.
I want to begin to bring our callers in here. They're eager to join. Let's turn to them. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Nazir is calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Nazir. You're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing? How is everybody?
Very well, thanks, Nazir.
Okay. I have two comments. One comment, the first comment I want to say is that when the Jerusalem fall to the Muslim hand in the first time in the around the second Khalifa of Islam, when the Khalifa traveled to the city, and one of the priests of the one of the churches over there, he asked the Khalifa to pray inside the church. The Khalifa refused, said, "Well, but I'm after on my peace." He said, "Yes, I know that, but I don't want to pray in it because I'm afraid the Muslim will convert to it. And that's why I don't want to pray. This is the first my comment.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know if the author knows about this story or not. And the second comment is, I mean, the crusade has been done, like, about the first crusade is when those two authors they were talking about. And the second crusade is in World War One when the British and the French divided the Middle East. And the third one, when 1948, when the United Nations gave the Palestinian and Palestinian homes and land to the Jewish in Europe. And the fourth one is what America is doing now to support the leaders in the Islamic unelected leader for the Muslim. You know,
so the history looks very much alive to you, Nazir. Let us pick that up. Thomas Asbridge, Jonathan Phillips, you can hear our caller renumbering the Crusades. He calls all of the early ones number one and then brings it right into the 20th century and up to date with more modern European Western interventions in the Middle East. Jonathan Phillips, you know this is very much alive in the
sure.
Islamic world's conversation about what's gone on in the last century and what goes on today. How do you look at it? As a historian, does this look like too loose a reference to what happened 1,000 years ago or a very relevant reference?
I can see the relevance in the way of Westerners attacking and killing people in the Middle East. The distinction that I draw and why I would say that the present activity is not a crusade is that crusading is a holy war. And I don't think World War One, events of 1948 and in the present day, those are not called in the context of a divinely inspired mission on behalf of the West against Islam. The medieval crusades were, rightly or wrongly, but the events of the 20th and 21st century from the West is a secular society. It's the idea of just war, which may have a mandate from a political institution, something like the United Nations, but it's certainly very, very different from the holy war of medieval times.
Let me ask you, I realize it's very different in the way it's understood, the way it's talked about, and yet, I don't want to make an artificial connection here, but I must say, George Bush talks about all humanity's God-given right to freedom and, by extension, democracy. Perhaps not in the UK, but in the US, it's not much of a stretch to see the Almighty tied into this effort.
Sure, I recognize that very much. And I think the sort of Bush presidency, with its strong religious leanings, that's how it's sort of perceived over here, is something that is beginning to blur that line. And the fact that he chose to use that word, and I know he apologized soon afterwards, was perhaps an indication of the way that he sees it. So I would personally view that as a rather dangerous, difficult line to go down. I don't think it's very helpful to add the religious element to it. It certainly opens up the connections with the medieval times very overtly for people to draw those links to.
Thomas Asbridge, let me ask you about the way the word crusade is and is not used today. It was very recently that it was used for all kinds of purposes before 2001. And, of course, Eisenhower used it, crusade in Europe, to talk about his military command in World War II. Lloyd George used it, talking about the Great Crusade in World War One. Now, suddenly, it's taboo, but the word does have a bigger meaning, has come to have a bigger meaning, has it not, than simply the clash of Christendom and Islam 1,000 years ago?
I think it has in Western society, but I think it's very important to recognize that in the 20th and 21st century, I think the medieval perception of crusading or what crusading really meant in the Middle Ages has had a much greater and prevalent role in popular conception and popular imagination in Islam than it has in the West. I mean, I guess one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book about the First Crusade was to try and remind the West what had actually happened in the Middle Ages, to try and bring this whole era of history back to the forefront of people's minds, because it certainly has been at the forefront of popular culture in Islam throughout the 20th century. And it's been manipulated. I mean, the history of the Crusades, as I think, has been heavily manipulated by certain groups within Islam, groups that have political axe to grind, that have ideological axe to grind, be it from Arab nationalists like Nasser all the way to Islamists like Osama bin Laden.
the Crusades offer them an opportunity to provide a rallying call for whatever their vision of Islam is. So I think it's important for us to recognize that we should be aware of our history, of what the West has done in this past and how it affects the world around us. I think in terms of actually using the word crusade now, I think I would argue in favor of what Jonathan's suggesting, that really what we're seeing here is a just war and not a holy war. But I think there's an important parallel to draw between George Bush and Pope Urban II, the man who launched the First Crusade. Mm. Both of these men are utilizing one of the most powerful tools in terms of rulership. They're describing their enemy effectively as the other. Urban described the Islam as an alien race, almost describing them like an alien species, someone who wasn't human. Mm-hmm. And I think a dangerous line that George Bush has been crossing in the last frequent years is to suggest that Islam and that people like Osama bin Laden and his followers in Al-Qaeda are literally subhuman, that they have no agenda, they're literally mindless terrorists. I would never for one second endorse Osama bin Laden's ideals, his aims, but he does have a goal, and we need to try and understand what type of past he's trying to draw on, trying to understand how he's manipulating history so that we can argue the other side.
Steve is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm really glad that a couple new books on the Crusades have come out, and I'd like to recommend a really wonderful book by Amin Maalouf. The English translation is titled The Crusade Through Arab Eyes.
Okay.
And it's a superb history. I'd appreciate hearing the author's opinions in reference to their own work. But if you don't mind, there's a wonderful poem written just before the Crusades that I'd like to read for you.
Make it quick. We've got 1 minute.
Yeah. The poet is Abul Ala Almari, who Almari is a town just south of Antioch, mentioned before.
Launch it, Steve. We're getting to the break here.
The inhabitants of the earth are of two sorts, those with brains but no religion, and those with religion but no brains.
Ooh, and this is his description of he's contrasting the Europeans he's seeing.
No, he was writing in his Islamic world at times, before the Crusades were launched. But it does seem appropriate for his time and ours.
Wow, that's a tough black and white he's drawing there. Steve, thanks very much for calling in. Amin Maalouf, Crusades Through Arab Eyes, Jonathan Phillips, have you read it? How is this written about in the Islamic world?
This is a book that tries to put forward some of the sources that are written in Arabic, which it has to be said, a lot of Western historians do not have Arabic and do not have access to them.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the start of an important sort of series of events that are going on in crusading historiography at the moment, when more and more of these works from the Islamic world are being translated into English, into Italian, into French. I think it's valuable. It certainly allows us to see the way that ideas such as jihad, the Muslim holy war, have developed over time. And it's quite interesting to see the parallels. There's a lot of strong parallels between crusading ideas and jihad ideas. So it's part of that step.
Thomas Asbridge, Jonathan Phillips, please stand by in London. We're going to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the Crusades, Christendom versus Islam 1,000 years ago. You can join the conversation tonight. Whether George Bush uses the word or not, is the U.S. embarked on a kind of new crusade in the Middle East today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Crusades and their continuing resonance 1,000 years nearly after they unfolded, nearly 1,000 years ago. Joining me tonight from the University of London, Thomas Asbridge, author of The First Crusade, A New History, and Jonathan Phillips, author of The Fourth Crusade and the Sack of Constantinople. They were bloody, they were brutal, they had all kinds of consequences on the battleground and on the way back to Europe that many never anticipated. You can join the conversation tonight. How do you see the resonance of the Crusades today? Are American soldiers in Iraq crusaders, or is the term irrelevant now? And is Washington reenacting a kind of version of medieval history or doing something entirely new? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Raj is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Raj. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I would like to make an important point regarding the issue of language.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that in Arabic, the word for crusader is a person for the cross, and the crusades are referred as the wars of the cross.
Very explicit. It's Christianity.
It is very explicit, and therefore and that's the word that Osama bin Laden uses, the people of the cross.
And what should we take from that, Raj?
Pardon?
What should we take from that?
That it is going to create enormous danger for the people of the Eastern Christian churches. They are now increasingly being persecuted.
The Christians living in Islamic countries today.
In Islamic countries. I mean, this is something that for over 1,000 years the Muslims were tolerant of Christians. There were, of course, minor situations here and there, but by and large, especially under the Ottomans, the Jews and the Christians were protected by the state, and there were many communities that were thriving, and it was generally accepted that people coexisted. But now one is seeing, for example, the attacks on the churches in Baghdad.
Yes.
This is something that has not happened in Islamic history for a long time.
It's an important reminder that you bring us, Raj. Don't look at this as musty old history. This
right,
is still
right. It is with us now, and the language confuses things. Just as the word jihad, which is the Arabic word for struggle, which is also used to describe the labor of a woman in childbirth, is often misused.
It takes on a whole new coloring in this current context.
Yes, yes.
Raj, thank you very much for that. Jonathan Phillips, that's a good jumping off place, I think, to consider how these two religions, attitudes one toward the other, changed in the crucible of the Crusades. What was the evolution? Where did it begin? Before these great wars were undertaken, and how did it change in the heat of those wars and after?
The Crusades certainly did bring about a change of attitudes. I think one area that you can look at that is also relevant today is in Spain. Spain is an area in the medieval times where Christians and Muslims had lived in quite close cooperation. They lived pretty well alongside one another. When the Crusades arrived at the end of the 11th century, that sharpened things. Conflicts became driven by religion, this idea that the Christians could gain a spiritual benefit for what they were doing and that they had a right to remove the Muslims from their lands is something that really brought an intensification to that conflict. And of course, the parallel you have today was the Madrid bombings, where the Al-Qaeda propaganda pointed out that, yes, they'd struck at one of the hearts of European crusading. They reminded the world of a fact that is largely forgotten. Crusading didn't just take place in the Middle East, in the Holy Land. It took place in Spain, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those Madrid bombs were designed to, in part, draw that point out. But it's certainly, going back to your basic point, it really made things from a situation of some coexistence to a situation of hard-edged conflict.
And Thomas Asbridge, you've said that it wasn't really even until after the First Crusade that this West versus Muslims antipathy was really solidified. How did that happen? Was it because of the stories brought back, or was it a deliberate campaign? How did it come to pass?
I think actually it's what's interesting is that there are two levels to this. On the one hand, there's the reality of what actually happens during the First Crusade and what happens afterwards in terms of the relationship between Islam and the West. And in one way, there's actually a positive message to take from the Crusades. It sounds bizarre, but for religious relationships, I really think there is. Because after the First Crusade, Western Europe basically established a series of settlements, satellite settlements, in what we now think of as the Holy Land.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality of the picture was that within just a few short years, within a single decade, Christians, Western Christians living in the East, and Muslims learned to live side by side. There are examples as early as 1108 of Christians and Muslims fighting alongside each other against a common enemy. So that's what's really happening in reality on the ground. But what starts to take over is what you might describe as the myth history, or the propaganda that surrounds this world, both in Western Europe and amongst Muslim leaders. Most famously, the man who sticks out now in memory and is often recalled by Islamic leaders
in the Near East now is Saladin. Mm-hmm. And Saladin, who effectively struck the revengeful blow against Christianity in 1187.
The great Muslim military leader.
Yeah, he's the man who reunites the Muslim world and takes back Jerusalem in 1187. Mm-hmm. And he's the man that someone like Saddam Hussein parallels himself against. If you look at a stamp from Saddam Hussein's regime, if you look at his banknotes, he has his face next to Saladin's face. This all in spite of the fact that Saladin was actually a Kurd. This is the politely forgotten under Saddam Hussein's regime. But he parallels himself as this great avenger of Christian crimes. And I think both in the West and in Europe, both in the Middle Ages and perhaps even today, it's the propaganda that's really driving this religious conflict, not the reality of how things work on the ground.
Ironic that you look back to the time when Christians saw violence against Islam as a path to salvation. Here we are in the 21st century, and it's reversed, where Muslim extremists call on young Muslims to achieve their own kind of salvation through violence now against the West.
Yeah, and I think it's salutary to remember that Islam has never had the sole rights to the idea of martyrdom. The Crusaders, we talked earlier on about what might inspire people to go on this crusade, what they were thinking, and how Jonathan remarked on the fact that even in spite of all these heavy casualties, they're still willing to do this. I think a very important part of that is that they believe that by going on this campaign, and even by dying in this campaign, they're going to achieve a place in heaven. And it's a persistent message that's obviously now very prevalent in certain elements of Islam.
Muhammad's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hello, Muhammad. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I wanted to comment, actually your previous caller has already touched upon this. The word jihad was mentioned and the holy war also. So the term holy war was actually coined by crusaders and not by Muslims. And the jihad never meant holy war. There is no word in Arabic language for holy war. Jihad doesn't mean that. It means struggle. It means striving for something good. For example, the Prophet Muhammad said that the best jihad is saying the truth in front of a cruel ruler. And also, jihad can be against your own self, your own desire. So it is a very broad meaning, very, very good word, which has been misused, very narrowly and wrongly interpreted as holy war. There is no concept of holy war in Islam, actually.
Muhammad, we've got it, and thanks for calling. Jonathan Phillips, how about it? Islam had expanded geographically quite vigorously in the centuries before the Crusades, but Muhammad's saying jihad never meant holy war, not in the sense we understood it in the Crusades or today.
I think there's two sorts of jihad, as I understand it. The greater jihad is the one that Muhammad referred to. That's certainly the one of the jihad of the soul, the struggle for striving of perfection. But there is also the lesser jihad, which is the one that takes place in the world. And that has the idea of extending the sway of Islam until the world is under Islam. There's also a defensive duty on Muslims, which is to look after their lands and to sustain them against outsiders. So I think you do have a holy war element in it. I think it's also important to note that jihad is something that dates from the time of Muhammad. It's a Quranic idea. Crusading was invented in 1095 by Pope Urban II. Jihad is not a response to it. It's something that Muslim propagandists, Muslim scholars and clerics at the time can employ from their spiritual and theological armory to take on and to respond to the West's new invention.
So a couple of different interpretations there. Pauline's calling from Swampscott, Massachusetts. Hello, Pauline, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you.
Yes.
There was a group of people who feared the Crusades more than anything, and that were the Jewish communities across Europe. I'm sure you must have come up across, in your research.
Yes.
Of how on their trip across Europe, they decimated Jewish communities, burned their synagogues. And what's interesting, is that it was the Arabs at that time who presented a chance to live in peace in their lands when the Jews were driven out of Spain.
Right.
when the Spanish had defeated the Moors and all those Islam groups.
So a more tolerant home in Islam then, and some very tough treatment at the hands of Crusaders. Pauline, let us pick that up, and thank you. Thomas Hasbridge, you write about that, how the Crusaders, it's a terrible way of looking at it, but kind of warmed up before they ever left Europe, wiping out some considerable Jewish communities.
Yes, and it's what has been described as the first Holocaust. It's one of the most distressing and horrific moments in the entire Crusade. But what I think is interesting about it is that in the past, it's been suggested, certainly in the time of Runciman, a historian you referred to earlier, it was suggested that this was a rogue element of the First Crusade that carried out these pogroms against Jews that massacred hundreds of perhaps thousands of Jews in the Rhineland. But what I think what the reality is, what we now understand, is that this early expedition of the Crusade was actually much more controlled than we've ever imagined. It had aristocratic elements in it. There were certainly knights present. And it wasn't an aberration. It was part and parcel of what crusading meant, I think. And it's important to realize that, you know, this is not just an unlikely and detestable offshoot of crusading. This is what crusading was about. It was about hatred of the other. I think Pauline's point is also very, very important to recognize Pauline's point about Islam's recognition of other religions. An earlier caller referred to it. Islam's attitude, certainly over the last 1,000 years towards other religions, has been based, if you are a scripturally based religion, what they call the peoples of the book, and of course includes Christians and Jews, then they offer real toleration and rights to worship. And it's, and in the modern world, where Islam is described as this very, very overbearing religion, one that you associate with undemocratic and totalitarian regimes, it's very easy to forget that element of tolerance.
It's also just an irony, if I can add, that the armies of the First Crusade, when they attacked Jerusalem, it's Muslims and Jews who are shoulder to shoulder defending the walls of the Holy City against the Crusaders. That's a little connection that's often forgotten.
It's quite an image, given what's going on today. Jonathan Phillips, we've just got a couple minutes left, but of course it all ended with Christendom itself splitting, Constantinople being sacked, so many of the great prizes we see, trophies held up in Venice and elsewhere in Europe today, brought back from a city, a Christian city, left completely destroyed.
Yes, this is one of the sort of terrible events of crusading. The Fourth Crusaders had originally set out to try to recapture Jerusalem, but they got sidetracked for various reasons. They were betrayed by their Greek allies. They were stuck outside Constantinople. And in the end, they constructed a case where they could attack and kill these heretics. And in April 1204, that's what duly happened. As you say, they broke into the wonderful city. They polluted the place. They destroyed it. They seized the treasures. Yet, for themselves, they regarded this as a divine blessing. How else could they have succeeded? How else can an army of, say, perhaps 15,000 people get in a city with a population of about 360,000. There's no other explanation to them for it.
But power, even within the kind of European and Christian realm, transformed in the end, not just what happened abroad, but what happened near home.
Yeah, I think the Fourth Crusade is something that did receive considerable disapproval in the West. They did not come home the heroes and the great conquerors. Some of them certainly were well-received in their homelands, but they did receive a lot of criticism as well.
So in the end, a deep division right there at the doorstep. Jonathan Phillips, with your new book, The Fourth Crusade and the Sack of Constantinople, thank you so much for spending some time with us tonight.
Thank you very much indeed.
And Thomas Hasbridge, author of The First Crusade, A New History, thanks for your work and thanks for sharing it with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
There we are, new perspective on a very, very old bit of history that doesn't seem so old tonight. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.